Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, an insurrection at the Capitol. The shockwaves from the attack by pro-Trump extremists in our nation's capital continued to reverberate. Calls for Trump's removal from office have grown. The resignations of top administration officials are piling up, and questions are being raised as to why the mob was able to so easily breach the building. At the same time, preparations continue for the transfer of power on January 20th, when Joe Biden and Kamala Harris will take over the nation's executive branch, with Democrats also holding majorities in the Senate and the House. My guest, Norman Ornstein, is resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. We spoke Friday morning about what happened and what needs to happen in the final days of Trump's presidency. Norm, calls are growing for Trump to be immediately removed from office. What do you think should happen now?
Well, we know that Donald Trump, to be blunt, is a clear and present danger to the country. Everything that's happened, the fact that people close to him have said, anonymously, of course, that he has lost his mind, that he is unhinged, the actions that he's taken. You know, Diane, we have such an odd political system compared to other established democracies. I was talking with some Australian friends the other night. You know, in a parliamentary system, they have an election. If there's a change in power, it happens immediately. We go months with a losing president, with all the powers of the president, including those of the commander in chief. And even though we have a short time to go, think of the things that an unhinged president could do, especially one who we know, even if he gives up power reluctantly, voluntarily, wants to leave a scorched earth for his successor. And remember that military leaders are pledged to obey any legal order of a commander in chief. And if he says to military leaders, Iran is out of control, I want you to bomb Tehran, that's a legal order, as we are now. And there are other things he can do, obviously. So I'd love to get him out of there now. I'm not a big fan of Mike Pence in a whole lot of ways, but he's not going to destroy the country. And remember, one of the other things that Trump has been doing is to make sure that his flunkies, who he put into the Department of Defense, will not cooperate with the Biden transition at a time when we are at some significant peril with enemies abroad.
But on the other hand, do you think what happened the other night changes all that? Do you believe that having seen the destruction, the mayhem that occurred, those flunkies, as you call them, will be far more cautious moving forward?
I would hope so, but I don't think they're going to cooperate anymore. And I don't know what a Trump will do, cornered and caged. What I do know is we're going to see a whole lot of pardons, and that might include pardoning some of the thugs and who participated in the mob. It wouldn't surprise me that he will now try to pardon those people at the Department of Defense. You know, we'll get into this in more detail, I'm sure, Diane, but Fiona Hill, who many remember from the impeachment hearings, who is a very sane, sober, and experienced and knowledgeable person, said very flatly this was a coup attempt, and I believe it was, an unsuccessful coup attempt. And we're now learning more and more about the role that the Department of Defense played, not just in blocking National Guardsmen and women from coming into Washington from the D.C. Guard, but now we know that Republican Governor Larry Hogan, even as this was taking place and the Capitol was being stormed, got a phone call from Steny Hoyer and said, Hogan said, look, I'll send in my National Guards, but I can't do it without the approval of the Defense Department. And they denied it. I believe that this was long planned as an effort to delay the House and Senate from doing their constitutional duty to certify Joe Biden as president and Kamala Harris as vice president, and very possibly to try to extend it beyond January 20th, but also that it's entirely possible that you had people who were trying to take some of the Democrats hostage and create a Republican majority for a brief period of time. You know, this sounds loony, but there's nothing loony about what we've seen. Now, we're going to get a reckoning at some point down the road. With all of that, of course, I'd like to see the swiftest way to get Trump from office. That would be the 25th Amendment. That requires Mike Pence, the vice president, to initiate it. He's not going to do that. Impeachment, I frankly favor the House impeaching him in part because I want to leave for future generations the clear notion that this is the only president who's been impeached twice. They're not, there isn't enough time where he will be removed from that office. But at least I would hope that people around Trump would go to him now and say, to avoid being impeached twice, resign early. Maybe they'll get Mike Pence to agree that after he resigned, he'll be pardoned. And just get him out, because there's still a risk here. And despite him now saying that he's chastened and that he wants a smooth transition, if you watch the video of him giving his teleprompter speech the other day, it was right out of a hostage being forced to say the words that his captives had put in front of him.
And how are his supporters, those who stormed the castle, as it were, going to feel about what he said about them?
We're back to the very fine people right now, of course, as he had not one word of condemnation for the violence that took place and still won't. As I talk about the things that he might do, remember that we have the Boogaloo Boys, another white supremacist group of thugs who are going to march on Washington. We have several events ahead where Proud Boys and other groups of this sort who revel in violence will be coming to Washington. We don't know how secure the inauguration will be. Frankly, I am now relieved that because of the pandemic, we are not going to have a full-fledged inauguration with hundreds of thousands of people on the Mall.
How is it going to be done?
My guess is that they're now rethinking even what they were going to do. If I had to guess, it would be that what was expected to be a much smaller gathering where they would social distance with chairs on the Mall. I'm sure that you have done, as I have done many times, and gone to inaugurals where you're packed together, hundreds of thousands. If you're lucky, as I've been a couple of times, with seats somewhere within, a few hundred yards of the Capitol, if not standing, that they would set it up with social distancing. I think now they're going to do it maybe even with a small crowd. Maybe they will have nobody on the lawn for the ceremony on the west front of the Capitol. Maybe they'll move it inside. I'm not sure. I doubt we will have any kind of parade of the sort that we are used to in the past. You know, it's a disappointment, but frankly, it's a very small thing in comparison to these larger issues that we have to deal with.
Back to the question of impeachment. Even if the Congress did vote to impeach, or even if impeachment processes were underway, he would be out of office by the time an impeachment process were completed. But are you saying that simply the beginning of an impeachment would be enough to keep him from trying to seek office again in 2024?
Keep in mind that you don't have to complete an impeachment process before he leaves office. He can be impeached and convicted after he's out of office. And that process, if it happened, would bar him from running again. But it could also be a process to remove the very generous perks that come to an ex-president. You know, he gets the Secret Service detail. He gets a very large budget for staff. He gets a budget for travel. There are many things. He gets a pension. things that I believe Donald Trump does not deserve.
You're saying that if he were impeached again, none of that would be available to him.
It's an avenue for removing those perquisites of a former president leaving office. It doesn't happen automatically, but it would be a part, I think, of the process. Now, you know, let's be realistic. Even after all of this, after we had armed thugs storming and getting into what should be the most secure building in the country, what is the seat of our democracy, even after people died in that process, 60% of the Republicans in the House and a share of Republicans in the Senate still voted to make the statement that Joe Biden was not legitimately elected as president. So we're not going to see a Donald Trump convicted, even if you see many of these people who've enabled him for 4 years now trying to remove the stain from themselves and get a little distance from him. But I do think that if he does something rash in the next few days, that could change the dynamic. You could imagine, you know, Mike Pence is not going to invoke the 25th Amendment at this point because the majority of the base would view him as a traitor. But what if Trump tried to launch nuclear weapons? What if he does something now or tries it so awful that it would be impossible not to see an effort to remove him from the remainder of his term? That could change the dynamic. But I also think that at some point down the road, we are going to get a full reckoning of the things that happened here. One of the things I want to say to those listening, assuming that there are career federal employees listening, in the remaining days, keep two things in mind. There's a Federal Records Act and a Presidential Records Act. Destroying any evidence, any federal records, is a felony. If you are ordered to do so and you comply, you are guilty of a felony. If you see somebody trying to do something like that, report it. The Project on Government Oversight, POGO, has a secure website for whistleblowers, because if those records are still there, we are going to see communications between the White House and the Department of Defense, between the Department of Defense and others that are probably making it very clear, including the Capitol Police, that they're going to make sure there is not a presence at the Capitol to prevent the kind of violence that we saw taking place.
Are you suggesting that the president had delivered orders to the Pentagon not to call out the National Guard? Are you suggesting that the National Guard could not be called out without that Department of Defense okay, and that they had received orders from the White House not to call out the National Guard?
I can't say that definitively because I don't have any evidence, but we have a lot of circumstantial evidence. We know, for example, that the top tier of the Department of Defense, starting with the secretary, were removed from their positions and replaced by Trump loyalists, most of whom had no qualifications for the jobs in which they were put in place. We know that in a combination with the head of the Capitol Police, that whatever attempt was made to create a secure perimeter around the Capitol did not take place. We know that even as this mayhem was occurring, the Defense Department blocked entities, including the governor of Maryland, from sending out the National Guard. We know that the people, the Capitol Police, and, you know, this is an odd thing. There were clearly heroes there, tremendous heroes. We also know that some of those Capitol Police opened up the gates to let the mob in. Others took selfies with them. There was some collaboration. There are heroes and there are villains. But the ones who died and who got injured in this process did so because the leaders of that organization, and perhaps the sergeants at arms in the House and Senate, did not put them out there with the appropriate equipment, protective equipment, and didn't give them the support that they needed for this huge mob. And we know that this was signaled in advance with neon lights flashing all over the place. We know that there were communications that said, we're going to create this mob. We're going to be out for vengeance. We know that they were directly egged on by Rudy Giuliani and Donald Trump Jr. We know that Donald Trump did not say a thing to condemn it until he was at a point where he had to do it in a rote fashion and never condemn the people involved. There are a lot of reasons to be suspicious about what took place. And in the light of day, when we get an investigation, and assuming that these documents or whatever evidence might exist of communications are not destroyed, that may create a different, larger impression of the president, or at least the role of those around him.
The head of the Capitol Police has already resigned at the request of Nancy Pelosi and others. Are you suggesting that he knew full well what was going to happen, that every publication, including Washingtonian Magazine, on that very day had said this mob is going to attack the Capitol, and yet the head of the Capitol Police refused any help from D.C. police or, in fact, the National Guard?
So I've been multiple times at the Capitol where the Capitol Police, if you get off a path by a foot, if you try and go in the wrong entrance, are all over you. I've seen the demonstrations that have taken place there, Black Lives Matter demonstrations, demonstrations for disability rights, and people who are peacefully demonstrating are grabbed up and often arrested, at least pushed off the grounds. Whenever there is word of a significant demonstration that is a peaceful demonstration, they are out in force, in full riot gear in many cases. That in this instance, where the president and others had signaled for weeks that this was the day in which they were going to storm the Capitol, that this was the day in which you had a skeleton crew, relatively speaking, of Capitol Police without the riot gear, with flimsy barriers set up around the Capitol, with no help from other agencies. And you know that these were decisions made by the top leaders of this institution. Their excuse might be, well, we didn't really think that they were going to be violent, and that if we had the full group out there, that it would then turn violent, that we could keep it. And but they've never done this before for what were billed as peaceful demonstrations. And in this case, every bit of evidence is there that violence was planned. So I'm not going to let these people off the hook. If these are simply bad decisions, there's got to be a better explanation than we have right now. And frankly, this was, as Fiona said and as others did, a coup attempt. This was violence. Let me step back for a minute, Diane. You know, as you know, I've been working on continuity of government issues since 9/11. And I started on that day when it became clear to me by the afternoon when United 93 crashed in the fields in Pennsylvania that that was a plane that was headed for the Capitol Dome. The Capitol is the symbol of American democracy and freedom, not the White House. And that mayhem would have ensued if that plane had not left Newark 45 minutes late and those passengers knew it was a suicide mission and not just a hijacking. It would have hit the Capitol Dome right around the same time as the other plane hit the Pentagon. We could have had a Congress beheaded, and it would not have been able to be reconstituted for months thereafter. So We began this process and created a continuity of government commission that was co-chaired by the late Lloyd Cutler, former White House counsel, and the wonderful Alan Simpson, longtime senator. And we focused on foreign threats, terrorist threats to our seats of government. On we had the anthrax scare, on a kind of biological attack, a little bit later on the possibility of a pandemic or something else. Domestic terrorism was not something that we would have considered. And now we have to go back and rethink all of that. And, you know, it's sad in a way because, you know, I go back to a time when I could actually drive my car right onto the Capitol grounds and walk right inside and not have to worry about any of these things. It was the people's house.
As do I.
And, you know, it's going to become much more of an armed camp than it has been. But this is of a different order than we have seen before. And if we don't take this entirely seriously, keeping in mind that 45% of Republicans in a poll done right after all this happened think that they did the right thing, the mobsters did the right thing, and that occupying the Capitol was a good thing. We have a very substantial share of the country, thanks to being inflamed by Donald Trump, who believe that Joe Biden is not a legitimate president. 140 members of the House and Senate voted that way. We're going to have difficulties governing to begin with, but we have to put a stop now to the possibility that we could have more violent attempts to overthrow this government from within. And the people who did this have to be treated in the most severe fashion.
Norm, President Trump has just announced he will not attend the inauguration. How much of a difference will it make that he is not there?
I'm glad he's not going to be there because I think it would take away from the majesty of this transition of power and take away from Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. But, you know, it's another example on hundreds, if not thousands, of how different Donald Trump is from other presidents. But there's something else we need to emphasize, Diane. The problems that we have with a party that's become a cult, that has no interest in governing, preceded Donald Trump and will be there after he's gone. Chris Christie yesterday tried to separate it all out and said, let's not confuse the message with the messenger. What you see now from all of these Republicans, including laughably Ted Cruz and Nikki Haley, now trying to get distance from Donald Trump, is they're trying to say, well, this is not our problem, it's only Trump's problem. That's simply false. This is a much larger problem than Donald Trump. Trump has been an accelerant of a process that's been going on for a long time. And that, again, is reflected in the fact that after you get a mob of insurrectionists trying to seize the Capitol and destroy the Congress, 120 Republican members of the House still voted in a fashion that would convince all of them and those who are out there who accepted it that it was appropriate. This is not going to be dealt with by simply isolating and condemning Donald Trump. His enablers have to be condemned in the strongest terms.
And Josh Hawley, being first and foremost a part of that group, I understand his book publisher has now said it will no longer publish his book.
That's Simon and Schuster. And of
right.
course, the downside to that is that Hawley now is trying to turn himself into a victim. Of course, the fact that Simon & Schuster isn't publishing the book doesn't mean that he won't get his book published. I actually joked yesterday, I wish that they'd gone forward and agreed to publish it and then limited it to three copies. you know, it's been interesting to see Hawley, who, of course, for his own personal ambition, tried to use this to vault to the top of the 2024 presidential hopeful list. And we knew what was going to happen is that the majority of the candidates were going to be running on the theme of, I'm just like Donald Trump, except I'm smarter and better. And he tried to get out in front of that. And then, of course, lifted his fist to all of these people before they seized the Capitol. What's been interesting is that Jack Danforth, who, of course, was one of the heroes of public service, who was a mentor to Hawley, now has denounced him and said it was the worst decision he ever made. And the two major newspapers in Missouri have, in the strongest terms, called on him to resign. So at least we're seeing a shaming take place there. The same ought to occur with Ted Cruz, who has been as shameless, but there are a whole host of others. And the fact is, all of them enabled him for 4 years through a series of outrages before this one. This is only one in the culmination of a process of shame.
And let me ask you about the administration officials who are jumping ship. Elaine Chao, the wife of Mitch McConnell, being among them. How do you see this going forward?
I was in some ways amused to see people leaving with 10 days remaining in the term. It's a symbolic step. And another one of those steps, Betsy DeVos included among them, of trying at the 11th hour to get away from this. I've likened them all to Lady Macbeth wannabes, out, damn spot. But they're not going to rub those spots away. But it's also a little troubling in the sense that if the 25th Amendment were invoked, it requires the vice president with a majority of the cabinet. And what's left unclear here is how you define the cabinet and how you define a majority. We have acting secretaries, some of whom no longer have legitimate power because they've been acting for more than what the Vacancies Act itself allows. We will have other acting secretaries coming in. Are they eligible to be those signing the documents? If you have half the cabinet posts unfilled, can the majority be a majority of the remaining ones? So to some degree, this is a cowardly act that could complicate matters. But of course, you know, that may be more theoretical than real because it's not likely that Mike Pence will ever try to invoke the 25th Amendment.
More of my conversation with Norman Ornstein when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Norman Ornstein, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. His most recent book is titled One Nation After Trump. So some have said that the mob who stormed the Capitol are a minority of Trump extremists, but they do seem to have extraordinarily strong support among Republican voters.
You know, this is a part of what's happened, I think, to the party, but it's also a reflection of what we've seen with tribal media and social media and the reinforcement that comes with it. It all starts, of course, though, with the fact that Donald Trump is the most significant opinion leader in the country as a president of the United States. When Trump started down the path of saying before the election, if I lose, it can only be because the election is rigged, saying repeatedly and sending the signal out there that the election was being stolen from him, going through this farce of what's now 63 legal challenges rejected by judges, including Trump nominated and confirmed judges, and continuing to say that the election was stolen. In his statement after these thugs had stormed the Capitol, in between saying, "Please leave in peace," he started by saying, "Of course the election was stolen and I should be the president," and then ended with that as well, while praising the people who were at that moment destroying elements of our legislative branch and occupying the office of the Speaker of the House and trying to get into the office of Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader. And apparently a Capitol policeman gave them directions, but they got lost in the Capitol as it was. So we know that there are lots of people who believe conspiracy theories, the QAnon theory and other elements of this. We know there are a whole lot of others who have been convinced that the election was stolen from Donald Trump and that you have to have a revolution to bring it back. Trump incited this, but let's face it, the Laura Ingrams and Mark Levins and Tucker Carlsons and Sean Hannitys of the world have aided and abetted this. The Murdochs have contributed to this. Lots of others have gotten us into this position. Now, I'll step back and you know, say something. As you know, I don't mince my words. The Republican Party, I think, has become, and this was, again, preceded Trump, but he's been an accelerant. What I would almost say is like a fanatical religious cult. Not all of them. There are heroes out there. Heroes in secretaries of state and election officials who stood up to this. There's Mitt Romney. There's Larry Hogan. There are many others. But what happens in a cult? First, the fear of being shunned or excommunicated is so powerful that people do things that they know are wrong. We have that element. A religious cult has a theology. A party has an ideology. The ideology of the Republican Party in the past included things like, we really believe in fiscal conservatism, and that means that you have the revenues to match the spending that you do. And if the spending exceeds the revenues, you increase the revenues. It means that you believe in a smaller, leaner, and meaner government, but the parts of government that you need should be run efficiently and well by the best people and financed to do so. It means that you believe in facts and science. And a theology is, and Grover Norquist had something to do with this, tax cuts are good, whether it's good times or bad times, no matter what the economists say. It doesn't matter if the facts tell us and the history tells us that they'll lead to huge deficits and debt, because we'll just wave our magic wand and say, no, they'll bring in more revenue. It's like the goose and the golden eggs. You create your own facts, that if you believe that there's no climate change, you just simply condemn the scientists because you condemn the facts. And if there are facts and you believe that all government is bad, and if you could get rid of it all, you'd have freedom and everything would be wonderful. And you make sure that if any part of government works, that it doesn't work well because people might like it and they'll want more of it. And like a religious entity, if somebody says, I've got incontrovertible evidence that the core of what you believe in is false, say, Jesus never existed, your reaction to that is going to be to kill the messenger or to say, no, you're wrong, I'm not even going to listen. And all of that has happened, and it is now at a point where if Republicans don't lose in 2022, then it's going to be even more difficult to turn this back to what would be a very conservative party, but a problem-solving party with an ideology and a belief in facts and science and a desire to solve problems. And, you know, I'm not saying that Democrats are angels here. Nobody is an angel in a messy political process. But we've got a big problem that's not going away when Donald Trump leaves.
So what do the Republicans do once Joe Biden is sworn into office? What do the Democrats do to move this country forward and out of the mayhem that Donald Trump created.
So let's start with what the Republicans are likely to do. And we've seen a game plan before. We saw it emerge first in the first 2 years of Bill Clinton's administration with Newt Gingrich's approach. We saw it in the first 2 years of the Obama administration, and again in 2013, 2014. And that is a party that will unite as a parliamentary minority in a system that doesn't support parliamentary procedures, oppose everything, block whatever they can, delegitimize what they can't, try to delegitimize the leadership and the president, and then use that to gain support in the midterms that follow. In 1994, that meant the first Republican majority in 40 years and Newt Gingrich as Speaker. In 2010, it meant a Republican gain in the House that was larger than in 100 years. In 2014, it meant control of the Senate. If that's what we see, and of course it will mean in the Senate the use of the filibuster for any major initiatives of the Biden administration or Democrats in the Senate, we're likely to have continued gridlock and difficulty even dealing with things like the fallout from the pandemic.
But considering what's happened in the last few days, do you believe enough Republicans are going to rethink how they approach Joe Biden's presidency?
I think a few will. I doubt there will be any in the House. Remember, we have extraordinarily slender majorities. The House majority is going to be reduced to the barest minimum because at least three members are going into the Biden administration. And remember, it's 218 to make a majority, and they've got 222, and it'll be months before those seats are filled. They will have the 50-50 Senate with Kamala Harris's role changing in a way that she may not have preferred, and she'll have to spend a lot of time in the chair. They will have one big opportunity, maybe two, through this process called reconciliation in the budget, where you can get the votes with just 50. But I'm very skeptical that on other major things, there will be 10 or more Republicans to be able to overcome filibusters. And then it becomes a question whether Mitch McConnell allows some things to happen without a filibuster.
Norm, you're sort of dooming the Biden administration before it even gets underway.
I'm saying that it's going to be a very difficult battle to accomplish major goals. Now, having said that, Diane, reconciliation, and I think they're going to be able to change the rules to make it more flexible, and they can do two of them. Under reconciliation, they could bring up a package that gets an expedited up or down vote with a simple majority that includes tax reform, health reform, a big stimulus, and COVID relief. I hope, being able to get rid of the debt ceiling as a political weapon, and infrastructure, and very likely get some Republican votes for some combination of that. Although, you know, it's not going to be the biggest wish list because you've got Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema along with the Bernie Sanders of the Senate. But they can do quite a lot through that reconciliation process. Can they do democracy reform, which now becomes even more essential? Not so likely. Maybe a minor package of voting reforms. Can they add the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico as states? No, not because those will be filibustered, and that's not something that you can do in other ways. What I am concerned about is Joe Biden believes he can work with Republicans, that they'll have an epiphany. Some will, and some will be willing to work with him on some things. But Mitch McConnell is still the Republican leader, and he will use that filibuster. Now, I will say the best thing now, immediately, in those two Georgia victories, is that at least Biden is going to be able to get not just his cabinet, but think of filling positions like the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and its leader, the members of the National Labor Relations Board, that McConnell would have blocked in their tracks if there was still a Republican majority, that he will now be able to fill. The FEC, the Federal Election Commission, the Federal Communications Commission, the Federal Trade Commission, getting judges where those vacancies occur. Merrick Garland would not be the incoming attorney general if it were not for those two Georgia victories. And that is a big win for the American people.
Also, Norm, how much of what President Trump has done, especially in regard to the environment, can President Biden undo?
Here we have another huge implication of the Georgia seats. It's called the Congressional Review Act. When Donald Trump became president with Republican majorities in both houses, they used this obscure law to erase a huge swath of regulations, environmental regulations, employment regulations, and many, many others, because under the Congressional Review Act, Congress, with regulations passed within 6 months or more of the preceding period, can by a majority vote erase them immediately. And the president then has an open opportunity to rewrite them. If that were not the case, getting rid of existing regulations is a cumbersome and lengthy process. So now Congress is going to be able to wipe off the books a significant number of the really onerous and bad executive actions taken by the Trump administration on the environment, on toxic wastes, on opening up public lands for other purposes, on some of the things that have been done on labor relations and in many other areas. And that's going to be a big plus for Biden. He will have a better opportunity to write his own executive actions, including agencies writing regulations. The caveat to that is we have a Supreme Court that was quite willing to let Donald Trump take a number of executive steps that may now move to rein in that executive power more severely.
Norm, you talked earlier about people like Laura Ingraham and Sean Hannity. What about the media at large? What about Facebook? What about Twitter? Even though Trump has at least temporarily been tossed off Facebook, he's still got a Twitter account. He can keep things boiling. What about the media as a whole, and what responsibility does it bear for what we've seen?
Well, let's talk on two different fronts. The first is the social media. And my guess is he'll have his Twitter account removed or suspended shortly, but that's all too little too late, Facebook and Twitter. And, you know, what Twitter has done in the last several months, including around the election, at least they put some caveats around the lies that he told, but they didn't say these are lies. They said these are facts under dispute. But there were some steps taken. Facebook finally began to put at least some curbs around disinformation and misinformation. I understand that these are difficult things to do when you have hundreds of millions of people participating, but they have been a part of the problem more than they've been a part of the solution. Now, I have a much more jaundiced view about our mainstream media as well. I cringed when Meet the Press put Ron Johnson on last week after some of the absolutely mind-boggling, horrific things that he had said and done. When you are allowed on as a commentator or a guest on one of these talk shows, you are given legitimacy. The signal is you are a legitimate actor in this process. And that's happened over and over. The larger frame of journalism, as you know, Tom Mann and I wrote a book in 2012, it's even worse than it looks, where we called out the Republican Party, which had already begun its descent. We called them an insurgent outlier, that they were contemptuous of facts and science of the existing political order, of the legitimacy of their opposition, and so on. And the response we got from mainstream media was attacking us and basically saying our job is to report both sides. And the false equivalence that's taken place, that continues to take place, the belief on television that you this is like a jury, and you have lawyers from both sides, and then the facts emerge for the public as the jury, doesn't work in a political setting. The legitimacy given to people who are not legitimate actors and shouldn't be viewed as such. The other thing that really concerns me, there's a certain amount of bandwidth in mainstream media for covering scandals. And for the Trump administration, because there was scandal after scandal after scandal after scandal after scandal, it all got lost in the wash. Nothing stuck at all. That same bandwidth is going to be there for Joe Biden, and we're already seeing it. He's not meeting with the press enough. It's the old look at the scandal. Barack Obama, as president, wore a tan suit. Can you imagine despoiling the majesty of the office in that fashion? And if the tan suit becomes the same scandal as encouraging the Proud Boys or allowing child separation while you deliberately try and keep information from parents and children, if the fact that we had press secretaries who held no briefings for months and then lied over and over again, and we get some small misstatement by a press secretary that gets blown up into something big, then we've learned nothing. And as I see it through most of the Trump presidency, the refusal to call lies lies, the desperate attempts to normalize abnormal behavior, the commentators who said when he was able to give a speech by reading from a teleprompter, this is when he became president. All of that, if it doesn't change, if we don't see a serious rethinking, we're going to be back in the same kind of disaster before very long. And of course, you do that, and then what do you get as a result? A president who calls you the enemy of the people.
Norm, you and I have spoken together for many years. On one of the last times that we spoke, you said that if Donald Trump lost this election, there would be civil war. Have we seen the beginning or the end of that civil war?
I'm afraid we're at the beginning of a very bad time. Remember that we're going to have still lots of people in social media and in tribal media. If it's not Fox, it'll move to the One America network, news network, Newsmax. And if Trump is not in serious legal jeopardy because of New York, what might be a Trump network who will promote conspiracy theories and foment anger out there with a large group of people who have weapons, lots of weapons. And I fear we're going to have an increase in violence over time. We're going to see it leading up to the inaugural. We're going to have marches in Washington with thugs returning. And whether the forces here are capable of dealing with it is a very open question. I have a lot of sympathy for those people in the Capitol Police and the D.C. Metro Police for what they're going to have to confront in coming days and weeks, and for those who are, you know, serious about fulfilling their obligations. Keep in mind, from what we saw with some of the complicity by some of the Capitol Police, what we know is that white supremacists have infiltrated a lot of police departments. There are sympathizers with these points of view in our law enforcement community and in our military as well.
And in the Congress itself.
And members of Congress who will exploit this for their own purposes. So if we think that this action on the 6th jolted people back into behaving in a normal fashion, that we will now all accept the reality that this was, by every standard, ratified by Republicans and Democrats across the country, as free and fair an election as we have had in a very long time. If we think that we're back to normal patterns, think again.
Norm Martinstein, as always, thank you.
Thank you, Diane. It's always a pleasure, although there's not much to take pleasure in these days. But I would say the Georgia elections, the fact that we had all of these people mobilized for the election itself, the fact that we have a president who I know from my own personal experience is the right person for this time because he is a genuinely empathetic, good person. Whatever his flaws, and we all have flaws, this is our best hope for bringing some larger degree of unity in the country. So there's reason to be a little bit hopeful, but you know, we can't let that deter us from understanding or take us away from understanding that we've got a lot of work to do.
That was Norman Ornstein, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and contributing writer at The Atlantic. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've written to let me know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Thanks for listening, all, and please stay safe, wear those masks, keep your social distance. I'm Diane Rehm.